The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This country is at war with Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. Operation Foxley was the name of the secret plan supported by Winston Churchill to assassinate Hitler in 1944-45. Different methods of assassination were considered, such as a sharpshooter or poisoning, through to a more elaborate plan that included hypnotism. With me to discuss Foxley is Eric Lee. Eric has been with us before in episode 130. We discussed the Georgian uprising against the Germans on the Dutch island of Texel at the end of the war. His new book is Britain's Plot to Kill Hitler, The True Story of Operation Foxley and SOE. Welcome back, Eric. It's nice to have the opportunity to chat with you again. When was an assassination attempt on Hitler first discussed? Do these things seriously come up before the outbreak of war?
Actually, no, they did. And there's a famous story of a British diplomat in Berlin who sent out a message to his superiors in London saying, if I look out my window at the right time of day, I can see Hitler. And you're given a guy with a sniper rifle, he could be taken out now. They talk quite openly about this. So it was a different time. But obviously that was never approved of, right? There was never a serious discussion about killing him until the war began.
I'm not sure now if sort of regime change through assassination is seen as being necessarily a right thing to do, a legal thing to do. And I'm not sure if I've just invented that there is some legality to that form of regime change, or is it just sort of a British idea of playing cricket?
I actually looked into this because a friend of mine who read my manuscript said to me, but was it legal? So I looked into this, and there's quite a bit of discussion among international law experts about could you kill foreign leaders? It comes up, and there's a whole convoluted argument about you can kill him, but if you have to do it almost like in a gentlemanly way, like you can't trick him. So you can't like put somebody into his entourage who secretly slits his throat during the night. You know, you can do it other ways. So that's the British version of cricket. But assassinations were regularly used in the Second World War. There's some quite famous examples of successful assassinations done by foreign powers. Usually not done against our side. It's usually done against the other side.
Because it did have me thinking. So because you start to think of, you know, like Saddam Hussein and stuff like that. You think, I wonder if it was legal regime through that kind of...
Regime change is a relatively new word, right? But if you look at the Second World War from the Allied point of view, it was entirely about regime change. We want to get to on all fronts. And nobody looks back and says, oh, you shouldn't have done that regime change in Italy. It was good that Mussolini was a good leader. Like everyone accepts that Germany, Japan, and Italy definitely needed a regime change, and it was effectively done. So regime change has been given a bad name in our time, but actually it was quite a legitimate and a very successful strategy then.
So we're going to look at Foxley. Now, is this the British, who is Foxley? Is it the SOE, Special Services Executive, or is it the Secret Services, MI5?
No, it's SOE and the Special Operations Executive, and the idea comes up in their council meetings. They have this council that debates big operations like this, and the council meets and discusses whether we should begin planning the killing of Hitler. And there are voices raised against this, including the head of Section X, which was the Germany section, who opposed the idea from the beginning. I thought it was a really bad idea, but the consensus was, no, let's do the plan. They never decided to kill Hitler. They decided to explore how it might be done.
So Foxley is essentially, it's a series of plans.
Well, yes, it's a series of possible ways of doing it, some of which are perfectly reasonable, others which are completely bonkers. And it's also tons of information about the vulnerabilities. Like if you're going to try to kill him, you have to know everything about him and his routine and all that. And much of that is incredibly accurate and detailed. I mean, the things they knew were extraordinary, and some of that is completely wrong.
You know, if you're going to assassinate someone, you need to know, most basic thing is where he is. I mean, how much do we know in Nazi Germany the whereabouts of Hitler?
That's the bit they got completely wrong. The most reasonable, least crazy plan they had was to shoot Hitler at his Alpine retreat near Berchtesgaden. That was a really, really good plan. And the only problem with it was, by the time they wrote the plan, Hitler had left Berchtesgaden for good. He never returned. Never. So they're drawing maps and layouts of rooms and discussing all the details of how you'd kill him when he wasn't there. To be fair to them, they didn't know where he was. His location, certainly in the last year or two of the war, was a closely guarded secret. And also, to be fair, remember there was this idea of the Alpine Redoubt, you know, where Hitler was going to retreat to and fight a final partisan guerrilla battle against the Allies. So the assumption was he would return to Berchtesgaden because it was this relatively safe place and he could hold out there for a few months or whatever. So they didn't think he was gone forever, but they didn't really know he was gone. I mean, they acted on the assumption he was living there.
And where are they drawing this information from? Are they... I don't know. How do you know what Berchtesgaden looks like? How do they know the plans? Because I'm not sure we had that many spies directly in Germany, did we?
No, we had almost none. The SOE was very ineffectual in Germany. They couldn't just tell the head of Section X, get your guys to take out Hitler. He didn't have guys, right? Because Germany, they wrote about it in the SOE's official histories that they couldn't really operate in Germany because if they went to France or anywhere else, they had local support. In Germany, the local were against us. So how they knew is interesting. Most of the key information they got was from captured German prisoners who were interrogated, meaning they were capturing men who had worked as part of Hitler's entourage, his bodyguards or his cooks, whatever, who knew, and they knew the layouts and so on. And the Germans, stupidly, throughout the war, kept rotating guys out. Like, you know, you're done guarding the Fuhrer, now you go to France. Then they get captured. So late in the war, the Germans stopped doing this. You're laughing because so much of this have a comedic aspect to the whole story. But the Germans at a certain point realized if you've been in one of Hitler's bodyguards, you absolutely cannot be sent to the Russian front because you might be captured and you spill the beans. But interestingly also, some sources of information they should have used that they had at hand, they didn't. So it's been pointed out that the layout of Hitler's study is, where his bedroom is and so on, is somewhat inaccurate. And that if they'd only asked people who'd gone there with Neville Chamberlain, they could have told them the actual layout. So they got some of that wrong. I thought the most amusing thing they got wrong in the whole report, I don't know where their intelligence source was for this, but there's quite a few kind of glaring errors, but they're listing everyone who's around, right? Everyone who's near Hitler, all his associates. And they mentioned, you know, Fraulein Eva Braun, who they describe as secretary. I don't think she even was his secretary. Where did they get that one from? But maybe some sensitive German soul didn't want to admit that the Führer had a mistress. So I don't know. That was kind of amusing.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much Eva Braun traveled with him or if she was there, if they could have asked, you know, diplomats who came and go, if he looked familiar with her.
She was certainly with him in Berchtesgaden quite a lot, and she was with him in the bunker at the end. But I don't know, I doubt if she went to the forward command posts, you know, the wolf's lair and those kinds of places. I don't think she would have been found there.
She's just one of those background people in a lot of the, you know, certainly those newsreel, not new, I don't know if they're newsreel shots, but those home footage shots. She's just sort of background where he's playing with his dog and things, isn't she? She's just with groups of the people.
Yes, and some of the footage, home footage, is footage she shot. So we've archives of Eva Braun's home movies, right? Actually, in the National Archives in the United States. You know, she's just a nice girl taking little movies of her man.
So you mentioned the sniper option there. I mean, that seems like the most conventional way of doing it. It certainly sort of seems like the Hollywood film sort of type, you know, where eagles dare. How are they going to do that? Because for a start, you've got to get an agent in, presumably. They've got to be doing something and not be found. We had problems enough getting people into blow up heavy water plants. Was it in Norway? I mean, how are you going to get into... Is it Bavaria? Is that where the Berchtesgaden is?
Yes, yeah. Look, it's worse than that. First thing, you start with Hollywood movies, right? So you think, first thing you do is you don't look at a Hollywood movie and think, let's do it the way it was done in the movie, which is exactly what they did. There was a novel written by Jeffrey Household that was very successful and still in print, called Rogue Male. It was 1939, and it describes a professional big game hunter about to take a shot at Hitler. In the book, he doesn't call him Hitler, but in interviews after, he says it was. And then it was made into a film called Manhunt, with a hyphen between the man and the hunt, directed by Fritz Lang, with Walter Pigeon playing the role of the assassin. And the plan SOE came up with, after like 9 months of research with the crack elite, but it was the script for the movie. That's what they came up with. Basically, one guy with like hunter's rifle. I mean, okay, fine, whatever. And Household, Jeffrey Household, who wrote the original novel, was actually an SOE officer. But there's no reason to believe he had any connection to the plot. He was doing something in Romania. So it wasn't a very particularly interesting or original plan, like to kind of shoot him. But it was a good plan because Berchtesgaden is a good location to shoot somebody. There's woods around it. You can hide in the woods and get a shot. The best part of the plan, which is extraordinary, is, you know, Hitler used to tell people, if you want to survive, you know, as a dictator hated by most of the world, you can't have the same routine every day. That makes you a security vulnerability. So no one can know where I'm going. No one can know my plans. I have to be, and he was the most heavily guarded leader in the world by far. Like they invented modern, protection of leaders with his bodyguards. They learned everything. But every day he was a Berchtesgaden, he would go for a 15 to 20 minute walk on his own, on a path. And he would tell his SS guards, you have to stand 500 meters behind me and in front of me. I don't want to see any of you. And it's thinking time. A man who knows he's setting himself up. And the reason I get asked sometimes, well, why would he do that when he knew that breached all security rules? Why would you make yourself a target? Because I think by this point in the war, Hitler thought he was divinely protected. He had there have been so many assassination attempts against him, some of which had come quite close. People who were with him were more likely to die than he was. He didn't die in these attempts. Other people did. He sort of thought, well, I'm actually invulnerable. If I want to go on a stroll with no bodyguards, nothing will happen to me. So the plan was to drop one assassin in there, a sharpshooter, a sniper. You dress him up in a German uniform. You give him a German weapon. He has had a Mauser rifle, which wasn't the best rifle for this. It had apparently a muzzle flash, so you could see where the shot was coming from. It wasn't the best scenario, but they thought if he's dressed as a German, he should be carrying German arms. So he had that. He had a Luger. He had some hand grenades. This is for self-protection. And he had all the detailed maps where to go. And this was the basic plan. But there was a plan B part of it. It shows some of the craziness of the SOE planning. Because in addition to this guy, if he shot at Hitler and he missed him, the plan was two other guys would be there some distance away, and they'd be carrying Piat, which is like a bazooka. It's like a British version of bazooka. And it's the kind of prototypical British weapon. So you're making all this effort to give him a Mauser with a Luger and a German uniform. He has to be a German speaker. But next to him are two blokes who are obviously SOE agents, right? So I don't know what they were thinking there. But the other part was, of course, you mentioned it a second ago, was the assassin. You have to choose a guy who's, you know, qualified. So you'd want somebody, a German speaker, ideally a native German speaker, somebody who's a trained sniper. British Army had some of the best snipers in the world, you know, who's ideally in theater, somebody could be, you know, flown in there and so on. Nope, they didn't pick any of those. The guy that they decided, it appears, the guy they offered it to was working in an office in Washington, D.C., He was English. His business had some stuff in Germany, so he spent some time in Germany in the 1930s. That's his knowledge of German. After he died and the story came out, his widow said he was astigmatic in one eye, so he had poor vision, and he was not a particularly good shot. He was approached in January 1945, and he was asked sort of, would you want to do this? And he sort of said, yeah, of course, I'd love to do it. And in March 1945, they told him, now we don't need you anymore, because Hitler's practically dead at that point. So it was like a weird plan full of holes with a sniper who, you know, probably couldn't have done it. And that's the most reasonable part of our mission. That's the part of our mission that makes sense. The other parts are really down the rabbit hole.
It'd be fascinating to know why they selected him. Was it, you know, is it an old, you know, he knew somebody who knew someone who vouched for him as being a solid, good chap, or, you know, it's such a...
No, we don't know that. Unfortunately, you know, the records are really quite incomplete. We know his name. We know some details. His service record is very incomplete. There's almost no evidence. There were snipers who like shot 50 Germans who were like, you know, world famous, who ran. There's a guy whose father established the sniper school. He was around. He'd killed over 40 Germans. Section X was filled with native German speakers. Nah, they didn't want a sniper or German speaker. They wanted this guy who was in Washington and working in an office. So
very bizarre.
It's really weird.
Very, yes, very bizarre. But that
and this This is the least bizarre part of Happy Shavasana. This is the most reasonable part of the plan.
Well, I was going to say that. So that's the most reasonable. They also consider poisoning, which, as you've already pointed out, it's quite hard to get even close to Hitler. How do you poison him?
Yeah, the assumption was a poison you could probably get to him on his train, because there was the water containers and they drank water. So they did a tremendous amount of research on what he liked, to drink and eat, and how he drank. For example, he was very fond of apple juice. We now know he would drink zero alcohol free beer. There's a particular company which would do a shipment every month to Berchtesgaden of this kind of beer. One of the most important questions was, and this was actually discussed, when he drinks his tea. He was a big fan of chamomile tea. When he drinks his tea, does he put the milk in first or adds the milk afterwards? And this was critical because with certain poisons, if he puts the milk in afterwards and there's poison in the water, they'll see it. It'll change the color. But if he puts the milk in first, then it's fine. So they researched, was it safe? Was it in the milk first? It was, a level of detail. So then it was choosing the poison. So they were looking for a poison. So I got to read all about poisoning. I actually called up a GP who's in our family to ask him about what poisons he would recommend. It appears they settled on thallium acetate, thallium, as the poison. We don't know this for sure because they only refer to it by code. I'll explain why it's a perfect poison. It's a poison where it works very slowly, is initially undetectable, and after a day or two, you die. And it was so unknown as a poison that when Agatha Christie used it in a novel in the 1950s, it was quite helpful in some legal cases where people died, no one knew why, because it was cited her novel. Because her novel, somebody uses thallium. This is a very stupid novel. It's not one of her best things. So it was probably thallium. But we know it's thallium because I actually contacted Porton Down, where they do all the research and stuff. And I asked them, what was the poison? And they said, look, we don't know, meaning we're not telling you. But there's a book you might want to read. And they recommended a particular book, which I read. The book they told me said thallium, we know it's the poison because this British biochemist was the expert on poisoning. He said that was it, was thallium, which was great. And I thought, okay, so we got it. We nailed it. We know this guy. He worked with SOE. He's the leading expert. He's his two portraits from the National Portrait Gallery. He's the definitive source on the poison that would have been used to kill Hitler. But I find this book by Robert Harris and Jeremy Paxman. They're talking about the use of poison in wars. Anyway, they have a lot of information about the guy, and the guy turns out to be a completely unreliable source. He famously told people, and Paxman quotes this, told lots of people, when Heydrich was killed in Czechoslovakia, he says, I added another notch to my belt because we poisoned him. But Heydrich wasn't poisoned. He wasn't poisoned. And there are academic papers now that go into this mythology that he was poisoned bullet or something, or poisoned dart, something kind of like James Bond killed him. He was killed because he was blown up and shot, and his body was exposed to filthy streets, and that's why he died, right? He was not poisoned. So the guy who said, I personally poisoned Heydrich, he's the source for the story that thallium was the poison to kill Hitler. So we don't know. We don't know. But thallium meets all the criteria. How you would have gotten thallium into Hitler's water supply in a train, no one knows. They didn't think that far ahead. They really didn't.
It's a fascinating drug poison to use, insofar as if it kills you 2 or 3 days later, they wouldn't necessarily know where it had come from. So you've got deniability. Oh, he's just died of his own accord.
Exactly. The only problem was if everybody on the Fuhrer train drank it, they'd all die, which might raise some suspicions, So there's a lot of this kind of stuff, right? Like you put this in because of deniability, and then you poison his entire entourage, so you blow it. It's like sending a guy in with a Mauser and next to him two guys with SOE equipment, right? So there's quite a bit of that where they haven't really thoroughly thought this thing through. They're sort of throwing out every idea they can think of, and we still haven't come to the truly crazy one.
Well, I was going to say, this is the Manchurian Candidate, the deep hypnosis. I mean, I think this is the most amazing. And I did mean to rewatch the Manchurian Candidate because I couldn't quite remember how it all panned out. But so, yes, this is deep hypnosis. How does this work? How is this meant to work?
This is where my partner said, you've truly gone down the rabbit hole on this one. And this is, I'm going to contradict myself. I'm saying this is the craziest, and yet this is less crazy than you think. That's my real point. In all the papers around Foxley and the whole dossier, you find this letter from a major who's in SOE who says to someone else, has anyone pondered hypnotizing Rudolf Hess and sending him back into Germany to kill Nazi leaders? not specifically Hitler, but they had this kind of little Foxley plan, Foxley B or whatever. You know, have we thought about using Hess? All the historians who've seen this memo and all the ones who've written about Operation Foxley all come to the exact same conclusion. This is insane. This is the craziest thing the SOE has ever come up with. What is wrong with these people? Blah, blah, blah. Yes. And I thought, yeah, that sounds right. It sounds like the Manchurian Candidate, right? So I watched the movie, not the new version, the original Frank Sinatra version, which is fabulous. The new one is terrible. And I read the book. I think what I'm going to tell you now is in the book, but not in the movie. Do you remember the movie at all?
Only very vaguely.
This early scenes show this Chinese scientist is showing the Chinese and Russians, this group of Americans on a stage, and how he's hypnotized them all. He's going to get one of them to kill another. And he says to them, again, possibly in the book, not in the movie, he says, look, I know many of you think you can't hypnotize someone to do things they don't believe in or consider immoral. He says, that's a fairy tale. He says, there's academic papers that an academic researched this, and he rattles off some names. You know, he says, so-and-so Brenner said this in 1934, and so-and-so said that in 1939, blah, blah. And I read this, and I think authors do that all the time when they write fiction. They make stuff up, right? That's what novelists do. But I'll just Google the name. I'm just curious. And it turns out these are real academic papers. The author of the novel, Richard Condon, actually sat down and found these academic papers from the 1930s and 40s in America, where they did experiments hypnotizing people and getting them to do illegal things, to break the law while hypnotized. This was very weird. The point is that when the suggestion came up to hypnotize Hess, it was based on the knowledge at that time, what psychologists would have been saying. So today we say that's crazy. We know, of course, you can't do this. But at the time, it wasn't so crazy. It was almost reasonable. And what was Hess like? See, the kind of guy who you could hypnotize, first of all, was hypnotizable. So any hypnotist, that turns out I know a hypnotist. So I called him up and we had a chat about this. And apparently, if you believe in hypnosis, if you think it really works, you're a much better subject, right? You can, if you believe that, I could get you to do things. So what was Hess? Hess not only believed in hypnosis, he was obsessed with hypnosis. I found his doctors, his psychologists and his regular doctors, who had him for 40 years before they turned him over to the Nuremberg Tribunal, they wrote this book about him, what they learned about him and all his paranoias and craziness. He was a very deeply crazy character, Hess, and was obsessed with hypnosis. And to, even to the very end of the war, I think in March 1945, He demands his guards come immediately to him as an emergency. They come to him. He says, I've written a letter. I want this passed on to Winston Churchill or the king. And what's the letter? He says, the following men have been hypnotized by the Jews, and you need to know this. So he gives a list, and it's like everyone in the world. It's Mussolini. It's all these people who have been hypnotized, because, including Churchill. How do we know Churchill was hypnotized? Because only hypnosis could have gotten him to become a Bolshevik or whatever he thought. He also believed he had been hypnotized. That's how he explains it. He says, clearly, I've been hypnotized as well. He was so convinced that it was probably, he said that the bridge at Remagen, right? That was the bridge where the Rhine was crossed by the Allied force. He says, clearly the German soldiers there must have been hypnotized. Why else would they have surrendered? So if you're looking for the perfect person to turn to a Manchurian candidate, here's your guy, right? He's out of his mind and he can be hypnotized. So I actually looked into this. I looked into who is the major who made this proposal, who was a real character. He'd served in the Red Army at one time and then wound up in the British Army, wound up in SOE. And he writes in his book, which is this really bizarre autobiography, about meeting a friend of his who was a hypnotist, who had talked him into all this stuff. I find that the friend also wrote a book about his experiences with hypnosis, which you can't find anywhere, but his daughter is around. And she sent me some pages from the book. And you learn where the story came from. So SOE was based on this, a guy basically doing magic tricks, convinced the SOE major to look into this. And of course, Derren Brown, you know Derren Brown, famously recreated this. He recreated a Manchurian candidate style scenario by hypnotizing someone and getting him to shoot Stephen Fry on a London stage. And you know, it appears to all work, but of course, Derren Brown's an entertainer, not a scientist. And he had two psychologists on afterwards saying, could this have happened? And both of them said, don't be ridiculous, you're an entertainer. In real life, it wouldn't have happened. So I wrote to both of them. 10 years had passed, and one of them said, I stand by what I said. It's nonsense. You can't hypnotize somebody to kill. And the other one wrote back and said, it might have worked. So this is where we stand. We have the craziest of all the stories might have worked. It's hard to believe the Germans would have allowed Hess back in the country, certainly not allowed to be armed in the presence of the Nazi leaders. That's all. No one's thinking that far ahead. And this is probably no crazier than the other things they came up with.
If you accept that that's the way you're going to do it, you have to have the next problem of how do you legitimately repatriate Hess?
But these things were done. I mean, there were cases of high-level German prisoners who were traded, like through Switzerland. There were a few of these, not very many. There were neutral grounds where they could trade some of the high-level ones, but this wasn't good. Even if the hypnosis thing actually worked, I can't see the Germans a lot. They didn't trust Hess. Hess wasn't like captured in the field of battle. Hess did something completely crazy. They didn't trust him.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back. I'm talking to Eric Lee, and we're discussing Operation Foxley. I'm right in saying the OSS came up with a similar sort of plan, a Manchurian candidate-type plan. So it's not as if the British are thinking in a vacuum.
The British, with all the craziness of their different plans, were not a match for the OSS. The OSS made the British look entirely reasonable, points I make. They brought in a guy, the head of OSS, Wild Bill Donovan. And by the way, if I were putting somebody in charge of my intelligence services, somebody who's nicknamed Wild Bill, I wouldn't put it in charge. Wild Bill brings in one of his buddies, a businessman, who he says is my Professor Moriarty. That's how he introduces him to his staff and gives him all these crazy tests. And he comes up with a plan to kill Hitler. But he's much crazier than the OSS. He says, we need to do a psychological profile of Hitler first to find his vulnerabilities. So they hire this top Harvard psychologist, Langer. Langer writes a book-length profile, never having met Hitler. Now this is, you're not even allowed to do this, but he analyzes Hitler and he discovers, he thinks, that Hitler is on the gender borderline. He's like sort of male, but not really male. How does he know this? He knows it because of like, he surrounds himself with homosexuals, first of all. That's a clue right there. His voice indicates it. There's a whole bunch of things. How he walks proves that Hitler is essentially female, meaning if you can tip him over the balance to the female side, his voice will become a soprano and his mustache will fall out. They realize. And so therefore, we have to find a way to get female hormones into the Führer. So they come up with, OSS comes up with a plan to inject female hormones into the Führer's vegetable garden in Berchtesgaden. And they will bribe the gardener to do this. So the story that they come up with at the end was clearly didn't work. And so the explanation they have is either the gardener just took the money and didn't do it, or there's a lot of SS officers walking around with high-pitched voices. And they literally, this is in the OSS histories. So compared to this SOE was completely grounded and realistic compared to what OSS was coming up with.
But they tried hypnosis, hadn't they? Didn't they try hypnosis in a couple of GIs?
They did. And the person, it was shown to this guy from OSS, the demonstration of this is what we can do. He said, this is ridiculous. There's a couple of morons who were being offered a free meal if they act a certain way. He threw them out. But in the SOE document, there's a reference to an American major, I think, in Ireland, who has done successful hypnosis things, but it's not clear who he is. It may be related to that OSS story or not. But the OSS was absolutely in another level of craziness compared to the British.
Right, so they also discussed rigging some flowers with mustard gas for him as well. It seems to get a bit James Bond.
Yes, that was the plan, that he was going to meet Mussolini, and they knew where it was. And if we get a vase of water in there, we can drop poison in, and they would go blind. And the day before we would do this, the Pope somehow would be induced to issue an encyclical saying that God will strike down with blindness the evil leaders of the world, and they will become blind the next day, and then all the Catholic soldiers will rebel, and that's the end of the war. So yes, these are the kind of plans. I don't think they attempted that, but these are the kinds of plans they were working on, the best and the brightest in the OSS.
So why did nobody on the Foxy team suggest that they just bomb Hitler, which seems much more realistic?
They did. They suggested it and didn't do it for some reason, but it's the only part of the Foxy plan that was actually carried out in the end. In the end, in the final days of the war, there was a massive RAF bombing raid on Berchtesgaden. So had Hitler been living there at the time, he might have been killed in that bombing raid. So no one really knows even why they did it, because it wasn't really a strategic target. But He was, that was the closest they came to implementing any of the Foxtrot plan. It was the only of the Allied powers, the only ones that really took seriously how you might kill Hitler with reasonable ways were the Russians, the Soviets. Their plans were actually more realistic.
Well, they potentially could have got quite close in 1939, is it?
Yeah, 39. Yes, because, and that was a kind of joint British-Soviet effort with the British government being unaware of the fact. This is there's a new book out by Ben McIntyre, who's a brilliant historian, called Agent Sonia. And part of the story comes from Agent Sonia. He relied on memoirs. Sonia was a Soviet spy at this point in the war. Later on was in England, but she spent a big chunk of her time in Switzerland at first. And she was given basically two British communists who were Soviet agents, were in Germany. They were kind of under her command. And one of them, before the other one arrived, one of them had a lunch break in Munich, just decided to pop into a restaurant and get something to eat. And Hitler and his entourage walk in. He's a Soviet spy, and he's looking at, that's Hitler. And Hitler is behind like some flimsy wall divider having his lunch. And he asks what's going on. So, no, the Führer comes here every time he's in Munich. This is where he has lunch. This is his place. Here's the guy Hitler was saying you can't have a routine and you can't give anybody a chance to kill you. He's like a couple of guys with him. When the other British Soviet spy comes upon the scene, they check it out together. They see the same thing. There's hardly anybody guarding Hitler. He feels completely at home. The war hasn't started yet. Who's going to take a shot at him, right? In his favorite restaurant in Munich. And so one of them decides, what will happen if I like reach into my pocket? Will the guards suddenly become alert? Think I'm pulling out a gun? I'll take the risk. He does it. The guards don't even notice. They realize we can walk in here with guns, with bombs. They decide, you know what? We'll come with a bomb with a timer. We'll leave it by where he's sitting. This is not like the that enormous oak table that saved his life in 1944. This is flimsy restaurant tables. How hard could it be to blow them up? And they raise it with Sonia in Switzerland. They tell her, look, we see it every time we go in this restaurant. He's there. It's easy to kill him. What do you want to do? She asks Moscow. It's now August 1939. Stalin signs the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Order comes down from Stalin, killing Hitler's off the table. This is the best chance they had. Hitler would be vulnerable, unguarded, two agents willing to risk their lives for this. Both of them British. I think both had served in the Spanish Civil War. They were veterans. They knew what they were doing. Didn't happen. Didn't happen because Stalin ordered not that. And it happens again later in the war when Stalin again gives the order, don't kill them.
If they had run Foxley, was there a contingency sort of what happened? Was a consideration put in? So we've assassinated Hitler. What happens? Because essentially, you could potentially make the everything worse.
Exactly. And this was the whole debate when it was first proposed in June 1944. That was the whole argument, right? There's several people saying, including the head of Section X, no, this is a really bad idea. This could make the war last longer. It could make him a martyr. You know, the people could be much worse and so on. They decided eventually that wasn't the case. They felt that killing Hitler at any point in the war would have saved lives. I think that argument was sort of settled when Hitler took his own life because the Third Reich didn't last 5 minutes once he was dead. True, they were at the end of their tether, obviously, but it looks like it's not like somebody would have come along much more powerful and effective. The argument then was that Hitler was an ineffective war leader by 1944, so keep him in place, the war will end more quickly. Except that Hitler dragged things out a bit. You know, the fight, the Battle of the Bulge and stuff, those things didn't have to happen. The war ended sooner. When you think about, and my publisher instructed me, you must write about this, like speculate what could happen. Who would have replaced him? The obvious candidates were Goering and Himmler. Goering was a totally ineffective war leader. We knew the Luftwaffe was bungled. It went from being the terror of the skies to being a laughingstock. Goering famously said early in the war, if a single Allied bomber bombs Berlin, you can call me, was Rosenfeld. He made up some Jewish name, right? And the Allies were bombing Berlin from day one, right? So he was a completely ineffectual, no evidence. He only knew Air Force, but he was an Air Force pilot himself. So there's no evidence he could have commanded ground forces. And he was, by this point, a junkie, and he was not going to do it. Himmler, who, of course, is sadistic and blood on his hands and a terrible person, was a completely ineffectual leader of ground forces in combat. He was assigned part of the front toward the end of the war. He didn't command them any better than anybody else. The competent German war leaders were the ones who were implicated in the July 20th, 1944 plot, like Rommel. Yes, Rommel was a great war leader, a bit overestimated, but he was a great war leader. These guys were not around, and the rest of the army was Milton was cowed by Hitler. So there were no like strategic geniuses who were going to do this. In fact, the guy who replaced Hitler, Admiral Dönitz, was actually quite successful, you know, admiral commanding the U-boat fleet and so on. But even he, there was nothing he could do once Hitler was gone. It's fairly clear that once Hitler was taken out of the picture, by this point in the war, the German armed forces collapsed instantly. So nobody knew this at the time. We know this now because of how it all ended. But Hitler was cutting off the head of the Third Reich, and nothing would have remained of the Third Reich without Hitler there. But we see that now. They didn't know.
The only thought I always had, which if they took him out early enough in the war, it could have ended up fighting to a stalemate or not going into Russia, or you know, there's all kinds of what ifs. We had to make that decision much, much earlier in the war, before too many dice were cast.
Yeah, well, I mean, the earlier the better, right? Because every day that was wasted was lives lost unnecessarily. But my own view is that killing Hitler at any point in the war would have saved lives. There was no point at which killing Hitler leaving him alive was a good idea. Leaving him alive was always a bad idea. You know, Hitler gave orders in the final days of the war that everyone still in concentration camps would have been murdered. That him would have saved lives. You know, in his very last days of the war, he was responsible for unnecessary, meaningless deaths. So the earlier the better.
This dossier, when was it declassified?
Yeah, this is a strange part of the story. It wasn't declassified until 1998. I'm not entirely sure why. Yeah, and it became quite a subject of attention then. A couple of books were written about it. They all agreed that hypnotizing Hess was the stupidest idea ever. But people didn't really dig into things like the whole story around the guy who was to be the killer, the sniper. Didn't really come out until after the dossier was released, when his widow was found and interviewed by The Guardian. And we learned much more since then about the OSS plans and the Soviet plans and so on. And the whole craziness of it is coming out more and more over the years. You know what it reminds me of is Ben McIntyre did that wonderful book, Operation Mincemeat, which has become, I think, a rather dull movie. In between the two, a group of actors in London turned into a musical comedy. And I went to see this, and I read the book afterwards. And I realized if you read Operation Mincemeat the right way, it is a musical comedy. It is full of comedic elements. There's a silliness to it. Foxley, I think, is a brilliant musical comedy. It's a very serious issue, and you know, I don't want to be too light about, you know, the Second World War, Hitler. These are lives are on the line. It's important. There are comedic aspects to the story that I couldn't get away from, which I found very strange. I've written about the Second World War before, and I haven't really found it particularly funny. This is funny because this is people sitting around, smart people, coming up with one bonkers idea after another of how to take out the most evil person, right? By the way, among the more amusing intelligence mistakes they made, where they announced that the Goebbels, Frau Goebbels and Dr. Joseph Goebbels had broken apart, split up, which was partly true. They had a terrible marriage, and she had fled with the children to Switzerland. Well, that didn't happen. We've all seen the movie. They murdered their children at the end of the war. Another part of the story was that Himmler was actually running Germany. Hitler was no longer in charge. This is in the SOE dossier, right? That was completely untrue. There was a story that Hitler had lost his voice. That's also in the SOE dossier. He hadn't lost his voice. I wish he had. On and on, these kind of really strange, you know, mistakes they were making. And the bit about Eva Braun, I think, is the best of all, his secretary, Eva Braun.
It's perhaps a reflection on how SOE is kind of a group of people pulled together sort of from the old school network, you know, because we could rely on them. They grow very rapidly and everyone trying to work out, so how do you do this espionage thing? It can't be that difficult, can it?
Yes, well, exactly. And they, you know, on the whole, SOE did an amazing job in the Second World War. I don't want to be seen as putting them down. They didn't, but these are people sitting in Baker Street and given a task like come up with something. And they come up with a series of one crazier day after another. You know, they had a plan to parachute in like a whole battalion of, you know, elite forces. And they would storm Berchtesgaden, where they say they would take out the guards and go, what do you mean take? Where they actually was undefended? They wouldn't just take out the guards. It's like a James Bond movie, working with your old pistol with a sniper on it, you know, with a pistol with a silencer on it. These were not undefended. Hitler was the most defended person on the planet. But that was one of the plans, send in an entire unit. There were plans to organize rebellions of Polish and Czech prisoners. You know, none of these were reasonable ideas. None of them worked.
And I guess these are really sort of almost brainstorming sessions that were probably not necessarily went that high up. Do we know how high up the food chain some of these ideas got? Does Churchill, any of these pass under the nose of Churchill, or they never quite get that far to being realized?
We don't know if Churchill knew about the plan. He approved it. And apparently, according to the document, he approved it in 1941. We don't know anything about the earlier plan, whether it was, I mean, wish they had done it in 41. So we don't know, but we know the Churchill's approval and Churchill's, you know, most senior generals were aware they were planning. Whether anyone high up ever saw the plan, I don't know. But SOE Council was discussing it from time to time.
It's fascinating stuff. I think we'll have to leave it there, Eric. Thank you very much. Loyal listener, if you want to know more, Eric's book is Britain's Plot to Kill Hitler, The True Story of Operation Foxley and SOE. The book also includes a complete reprint of the Foxley document, so you can read the original papers yourself. As ever, I'll put a link on the website. Next time, we'll be discussing U-boats. Until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
A 88mm gun hit our tongue, blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.